You're listening to Seminary Dropout, and I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. In cooperation with MissioAlliance.org, straight from my house in Austin, Texas to yours, interviews with leading Christian authors, leaders, and thinkers, because good theology should be for everyone. This is Seminary Dropout. Let's go. My guest is Chris Marlowe. Chris is the founder of Help One Now, an organization that mobilizes ordinary people to fight poverty by empowering Indigenous leaders to care about the world's most vulnerable children. Help One Now began in 2009 with a $1,000 investment and has since gathered a tribe who have helped build schools, rescue homes, and medical clinics through simple acts like garage sales, community concerts, and lemonade stands. Chris is a sought-after speaker at churches and conferences such as TEDx, Plywood People, Idea Camp, Together for Adoption, and the White House's Gathering of Innovators Doing Good. Chris lives in Raleigh, North Carolina with his wife and two daughters. Chris, thanks for being with me.
Thanks, Shane. Excited to be here.
So we should mention we got two friends here, Lamar and Ken, who are on staff at Help One Now.
Yeah.
They came along for the ride. So you may hear them in the background if they choose to jump in or not.
They're both musicians, cool. So maybe they'll sing first or something.
Okay, sweet. We'll have a musical interlude in the middle there.
Oh, boy. Lamar, try and sell you some CDs, too.
So you got this new book, Doing Good is Simple. I was there last night at your launch party. It went really great here in Austin. Let's start talking a little bit about Help One Now. I know, like I mentioned in the intro, they help vulnerable children alleviate poverty. What are some of the specifics about Help One Now?
Yeah, it's interesting, Shane. I was, kind of a church planter here in Austin, Texas, and ended up taking a trip to South Africa and Zimbabwe in 2007. In Zimbabwe, I met a starving orphan, 4 a.m., abandoned gas station. I kind of had this, interruption, if you will. My friend Greg Russinger always says, a life interrupted is a life inspired. And so I got what he meant when I was in Zimbabwe. I feel like God dropped me in the middle of hell and said, there are all these global issues happening. Wake up. We need the church to do something about it. We need just everyday people to do something about these issues. And so when I came back to Austin from that trip, what struck me was how many folks wanted to make an impact and do something to help, but they just didn't know how, and they never felt they were good enough, right? Like, I don't have enough money. I don't have enough time. Do I have to move to Africa? Do I have, And so we just began to have these really fun conversations here in Austin in 2009 about what if everyday ordinary people here in Austin really helped serve these 30 orphans that I had met in Zimbabwe. And that's kind of the genesis of the organization. Before we officially launched, I did a year research program trying to figure out, issues of poverty alleviation, global orphan care, anti-trafficking. And in that research program, one of the things that really frustrated me was everywhere I went, I would see outsiders leading. And I was thinking, how can we innovate around the world if it's always an outsider leading? We need insiders to be the face and the voice and the leaders. And what if people like my friends from Austin and now all over the world, what if we got behind these really brilliant men and women doing amazing work all over the world? And what if we help them fulfill their vision? So that's kind of the core of what Help One Now does. Is we want to be as invisible as possible in these communities we serve, but we want a tribe of people around the world to let these leaders know that they're not walking alone. They have a group of people walking with them.
Cool. You mentioned the experience in the gas station in Zimbabwe. Would you want to tell that story?
Yeah. He's trying to make me cry. That's it. Oh, man. Yeah. So, and it's funny. I've told the story probably, thousands of times in the last 7 years. And still, I think about it literally almost every day. We had spent 5 days in Cape Town before this experience in Zimbabwe. And I grew up just outside of Oakland, California. And so there's a little context here. We should never stop at an abandoned gas station at 4 a.m. These are things you don't do, kind of where I grew up. And so I remember after this 20-hour drive, a guy named Pastor John, he's a local Zimbabwean leader. He's a real quiet, very, very shy in a good way kind of guy, very gentle leader. And he says in his soft voice, he's like, hey, Chris, do you mind if we stop at a gas station? I want to check on some kids. And so I had just met John 5 hours earlier in the day on the border of South Africa, Zimbabwe. Now, Zim 2007 was on the verge of a civil war. Literally, people were starving. No gas in the country. Grocery stores were bare. I mean, this was a rough place. And so I say, Pastor John, like, man, like, I don't know, like, stopping at a gas station, 4 a.m., downtown Harare, 3 million people, not the safest place. Do you think it's a good idea? And he just said, I need to stop and check in these kids. And so I remember the moment driving into the gas station, and the light shone over, you know, the asphalt floor. And what I saw was just horrific. It was just dozens and dozens and dozens of kids, mostly between 4 and 8 years old. And so at the time, my daughters were 5 and 7. So obviously, from a father level, yeah, like, these are my kids, you know, and they're sleeping in this gas station. We get out of the van, which is full of supplies for these 30 orphans that John was caring for. And we're surrounded by these kids. And one of the kids grabbed me by the arm and he pulled me low and made eye contact. And he said these words. He said, "Thank you so much for visiting my country. I'm so sorry it's in the shape that it's in." And at the time, I didn't know. I mean, he's a young kid, pretty much naked. You know, you could see his bones sticking out of his body. Just, you could tell he's in rough shape. Outsiders don't visit this place very much. I mean, this is not Haiti, where every week you have a trip, you know, team going. Like, you know, this was a huge moment for these kids to have, you know, outsiders literally show up at their gas station. And so he says, "Thank you for visiting my country. I'm so sorry it's in the shape that it's in. I don't want to beg you, but is there any work I can do for you so we can get something to eat?" And I was just completely overwhelmed by this moment. Like, just the wisdom and the compassion and the humility that this starving 8-year-old boy was displaying in the midst of extreme poverty definitely took me back. But I looked him in the eye and I told him no. And we got in the van and we drove off, and my life was devastated. I mean, I just, you know, I couldn't quite understand. You know, I was mad at God. I was mad at myself. We have a van full of supplies for these other 30 orphans who are in need. And yet I told, you know, kind of a starving 8-year-old boy that I couldn't help him. And so at that moment, you know, just driving, we drove another hour to Pastor John's location. And I knew my life had completely changed.
So, you know, that was kind of the inciting point for Help One Now.
Yeah.
You know, I think helping others is so tricky. And I think that anybody who's done it, even if it's like on a local level, or if they've studied poverty or nonprofits or anything, you know, you mentioned last night the book Help When Helping Hurts. You know, I've had an interview with Brian Fickert and talked about that book. I think when people start helping, they think that helping people is going to be like checkers. Like, it's going to be real simple. And like, if they need food, I'll give them food, or, you know, whatever it is. And people get involved and they realize that it's more like chess. Like, it's much more complicated, or maybe some other game that's more complicated than chess, maybe. Yeah. And that last night at the book release, that was one of the things that Jen Hatmaker was really talking about, that Help One Now does well, because there's so many that don't do it well. And I wonder what you think is, like, for people who don't quite understand what we're talking about, maybe, like, what's a way that organizations in the past have tried to help in ways that weren't so great, and in ways that Help One tries to be different?
Yeah, man. So many, there are layers to that question, right? Because passion without wisdom actually ends up hurting more than it helps. And that's one of the great challenges, especially in the church world. The church is so, we're driven and we're compassionate people. We want to help. The story of the Bible talks about helping. But there's a lot of wisdom required to help. So one of the things we try to do Help One Now is we understand there are layers of people and their involvement. And so for the masses, you know, they're, you know, a CPA or a doctor or a plumber, like, these folks don't have time to figure out global development work. They are so busy with their normal life. They just need tools, and they need to partner with organizations doing good work. So part of what we do is, for the masses, we just say, here's simple, powerful ways you can help. for those who are kind of vocational or who are like leaning into this on a deeper level, there's this whole other side of it. And so, you know, the book, Doing Good is Simple, but doing good isn't easy. Simple and easy are two separate things. Mm-hmm. So the friends I was with in Zimbabwe actually were learning from Brian Fickert at the time and helping her. So before the book had even come out, they were like trying to think through best practices. Part of that is just understanding that insiders need to lead and outsiders need to serve the insiders.
Yeah.
And that's the biggest take to help them now. We realized back in the day, like, what if innovation can happen on a local level? So I learned literally, you know, a few hours before I met the boy at the gas station. I'm in this community with a guy named Pastor Willie. Crazy South African pastor, like almost like a cowboy in South Africa. Just, you know, this huge personality, laughing, having fun, just such a fun guy to be around. But I'm in this community and I noticed the kid's home has multiple colors of paint. And I'm trying to like figure this out, like, you know, why? And so first time kind of outside of my context, I probably asked a million lame questions. So I said, you know, Willie, why does the orphanage have so many colors of paint? And Willie was like, he didn't know how to respond. So my friend Steven, who was with me and good friends with Willie and lived in Cape Town for 3 years, is like, oh, Willie, just tell him the story. It's okay. It's a safe place to talk about your frustrations. And so Willie said, okay. You know, every year we have groups of teenagers that come over and we don't know what to do with them. They want to help and we love them and we're glad that they want to come. But every year they typically like play soccer with the kids and they paint an orphanage. They repaint the orphanage. So this community, like the homes have no roofs, there's no clean water, the kids don't really have a functioning school, the kids' home inside, like I wouldn't really want my dog to live there, much less a child creating the image of God. That moment was so frustrating for me. And then my friend Stevens are like, yeah, and you know, just about every trip with 10, 12 teenagers cost, you know, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 just to bring them here. And so basically we're spending a lot of money to play soccer and paint an orphanage. When they leave, the community is actually no better off and possibly worse because the community spent a week and a half serving these, you know, outsiders. Yeah. And so, you know, that's the whole point of like, we have to help. We have to use wisdom. We have to realize like we're gifted and part of what we need to do on, you know, compassion trips, mission trips, service project trips, is what's more important than projects is people. And I talk about that in the book. How do we empower and unleash human capital? So if we take these trips, why don't we, you know, what if business leaders here in America would spend time with business leaders in Zimbabwe and figure out how do we help you, you know, do business better or do healthcare better? Or, you know, one of the things we do is teacher training. We have teachers that go around the world and they train local teachers and they train each other. It's not one training the other. They have this friendship and this collaborative process. And so that moment just taught me that we have to be really thoughtful in how we spend our money and how we spend our time. And I think in the church world, Shane, here's the challenge in that space alone. For some reason, when we think of mission trip, we think of service projects, building and painting. The problem is every time we build something, someone's losing a job. After the earthquake in Haiti, you know, we would see homes being built by just a bunch of outsiders, while local Haitians would watch them. And those Haitians have no job. And so we said, what if we had the Haitians build the homes and we created jobs as we help people move from a tent to a home? So I think we're not far off and we're getting wiser in how to do this. But oftentimes we're thinking more about ourselves and the experience that we want as opposed to the people we're serving and how to empower them in a sustainable long-term way that would create impact.
Yeah. Well, I think so often we hear from leaders in churches who maybe they take their yearly mission trip, and the emphasis is often how it changes their people, right? It changes the people of that church, right? The experience of doing it. And often it's at the detriment of the people they're serving or helping.
So here's the challenge. Like, only the American church, and it's going to sound more critical than I want it to, it's crazy that somehow mission has become one of the most selfish things we do. It's about my people having an experience. And we always use these key words or kind of over spiritual discipleship, transformation. Well, they don't know if they don't go. But ultimately what we're doing is we're building these mission trips based on the needs of our people, mm-hmm. instead of saying how do, and really, it's not even a partnership. We may have friends around the world, but oftentimes there's not even this deep partnership. One of the things we realized, we can create friendships and real community between the West and the folks that we served, then the layer of thought would be, I'm not going to just serve a group of people for 7 days. I'm going to participate in this long-term journey with a group of friends who live in Zimbabwe or who live in Uganda or who live in Haiti. And we're going to do life together as best we can, even though we live in different contexts. We're going to listen to one another. We're going to learn from each other. We're going to pay attention to the details as much as possible. And then we're going to find how do we make a long-term impact in this community and yet be as invisible as possible, because we want the local church and the local leaders to be the heroes of the story, not an outside nonprofit.
As you know by now, I've been talking for a few weeks with InterVarsity Press author Kent Annan about his new book, Slow Kingdom Coming: Practices for Doing Justice, Loving Mercy, and Walking Humbly in the World. So you know, Kent, this book is great for those leading nonprofits and things like that, but also for the local church and maybe missions teams or small groups, or maybe even those that are going to go on a short-term mission trip and have done that every summer for a long time. What do you think the benefit would be for those groups to read this book?
Yeah, thanks, Shane. It's a good question. I really did write the book for these kind of groups. So I've already heard from people who are reading it before they go on a short-term missions trip. And it's got these five practices in the book that really help them think through as a grid. Hey, how are we going to approach this missions trip in a way that takes us to a level deeper? And or a missions committee at a church who can read it together as they do a reboot of how they're involved in local and international missions, and some nonprofit staff can read it together just as a refresher on, oh, how are we treating the people we want to, that we're helping, and how are we being shaped spiritually so we can do the best work possible to help people. So I really tried to make it practical, this practical book that's helping us shape our own spiritual lives, but also do the best work possible. And I think it can be helpful to all these different kinds of groups that you mentioned.
And this is the last week that you can get Slow Kingdom Coming for 30% off. This is an exclusive offer for Seminary Dropout listeners. To get 30% off, just go to ivpress.com/dropout and you get 30% off. Get a great book, support a great show. Thanks. So the book is a lot of things, but one of the things you really include, I say that in the best way possible, are just stories of, like you said, just normal people that didn't uproot their families to move to a different country. Yeah. They still have their same vocation here in the States, you know, living in the suburbs or wherever, but they did good. Do you want to just share one or two of those stories of people?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is the tension, right? Like, oftentimes, when we think we have, when we want to serve, we feel like we got to fix the whole world, or we got to solve all the problems and the weight of that. And even as I struggle, like, should I write the book or not, I begin to realize there were two conversations. There are these deep, very weighty justice books out there that require a lot of thought. I mean, you know, just really good stuff, but I mean, it's deep. And then there's a lot of books on justice where you just feel like you're being hammered. You're not good enough. We're not doing enough. We're not going enough. We're not like, it's never enough. Like, if you don't live in a slum in some, you know, developing world, you're just not a good Christian. And I'm like, man, how do I balance it out? So the book really is, you know, some theology, a lot of story, and best practices mixed together. And really, we learned that. Our friends at Austin New Church, you know, Brandon Jen Hatmaker's church, and their worship pastor is Lamar Stockton. He's right here. He's even in the book. These kids in Zimbabwe, these 30 orphans that we had met in 2007, they didn't have clean water. And so when I was there a few years later, they were literally walking around their community with signs saying, raising money for water. They were getting sick. And so we're like, we got to figure this whole, they need clean water, and it's a significant issue. And so they would go down to the creek, and they would fill, you know, three times a day, they would fill their buckets up with water and bring it back. And the water was just nasty, terrible water. And so Austin New Church, we kind of said, how do we raise money? And if you know anything about the church, it was small at the time. You know, they have folks from all over Austin from, you know, and so it wasn't a wealthy church. They couldn't just write a check. And so they ended up doing this all the small groups did garage sale parties for a weekend. And at the end of that weekend, we had enough money. I think it was like $12,500 to basically, you know, put a clean water project into the kids' home, the compound in Zimbabwe. And like, you know, 7 years later, hundreds of people every day are getting access to clean water because one weekend, 2010, a group of people from Austin said, let's get rid of our excess, donate it to clean water, and, you know, and have fun in a weekend. And so it's amazing something that simple can be that significant.
You know, kind of going back to just how complicated things are and just how overwhelming it can seem to do good. You know, you look around at all the problems in the world and, you know, there's poverty, there's a refugee crisis, stuff that's closer to home, you know. Yeah, I think it's really important that our churches are multi-ethnic. So we've got to work on that. We've got to work on our peer group. My friend Jeremy Courtney says I need to go meet a Muslim. And it's at that point where it starts to feel overwhelming just to be a decent human being, you know? And so I wonder how, in the midst of all those realities, how it can still be simple to do good.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things. One is in life, you have to choose your fight. You have to choose what you're going to go after, what you're going to pursue. If you try to do too many things, you're not going to do them well. And so one of the things I try to do this. I give people permission to say no. We can't say yes to everything. We can't solve every problem. We can't be a part of every cause. We can't help every nonprofit. You know, we just can't. And so I encourage people, like, find the one or two things that you're really, really passionate about, that you can use your gifts, talents, time, resources, networks to make an impact, and be okay with saying no to a bunch of other things. We live in an age, and, you know, our friend Jeremy is in this, like, everything's an emergency all the time. After 9/11, you know, we would hear things like the world will never be the same. And I figured, okay, I get that. But I think what I'm realizing today is what people meant back then. Like, our world is never going back to, it's emergencies, it's crisis, it's terrorism. So much explosive activity happening around the world, right here in our own backyard and globally. And so we have to pick our fight, choose your fight, go long. Doing good requires discipline and longevity. It's not a microwave. We can't fix it overnight. We can't solve all the world's problems. But, you know, partner with, you know, our friend Frame to Love. Jump in with them and say, man, I'm here and I'm not leaving. I'm going to be with you long term. I'm going to be with you in the good times. I'm going to be with you in the bad times. And so, you know, long term. And then, you know, I think the third thing is, like, give yourself grace. You know, like, ultimately, you know, depending on your theological outcome, like, we just can't solve everything. There's a sovereignty issue going on. There are things beyond us that are really important to realize. Like, you know, it's going to be okay long term. But we can invest the moments we have here to really live a meaningful life and make an impact. And then invest more in people than projects. We love projects. Nonprofits love projects. We can raise money. I could build 100 orphanages a month probably if we wanted to. But more important than building orphanages is building people in those communities who can solve their own problems. And so invest in human capital more than projects.
One of the themes that I felt like I kind of took from the book was just the role of creativity in doing good. You tell a story about how when the earthquake hit in Haiti and Help One Now is just kind of in its infancy, you know, you weren't mobilized to, you know, do whatever, jump on a plane or, you know, send tons of supplies, but you just had this idea of having somebody make a t-shirt design. You sold t-shirts and raised like $24,000 or something like that.
Like 60 grand.
Okay.
Over a year and a half.
Yeah. So, and it seems like that really seems to be a theme in how we do good where we are, is just the natural creativity that we've already been given.
Yeah. I think artists are the new prophets and poets of our generation. I mean, they have such, you know, they tell powerful stories. They unlock so much, you know, potential in humanity. And so after the Haiti earthquake, our friends Aaron and Jamie were adopting from Haiti at the time. And so we had just committed to going to Haiti 6 weeks before. We were hanging out in Thunderbird, Austin, and said, okay, let's go to Haiti. And then the earthquake happened. And we're like, man, the first day I ignored it. I didn't even like, okay, another earthquake, another tragedy. You know, I didn't. Then the second day, I think I realized, like, well, this isn't just another earthquake. Like, this is brutal. And so we just thought, how do we help? And so a friend of mine, Scott Wade, another friend of mine, Ryan in Portland, we just sent out quick emails. Said, hey guys, can you create a quick shirt for us? I mean, a local t-shirt company here in Austin, like 4 days later, the design and the shirt was printed, and we just began to sell them on social media. And we thought we'd sell a couple hundred, and we sold a couple thousand in the first few weeks. And then we mobilized that money through orgs already doing amazing work in Haiti. And so we were able to send, you know, emergency cash. And what was crazy, it's like a 10, 12 day turnaround before people were wearing shirts, and all of a sudden these orgs doing really good work have some extra money to that they needed in that emergency scenario. So I think, you know, there are big systemic things that we're trying to solve in the world. But there are also these really small, impactful. And if we do it right and with the right people, we need both of those things working out together to really do good and do it well.
Mm. The other thing that I was thinking of was just this idea that, like, people don't need permission to raise money to do good. You tell the story about a teacher who spent her summer raising money for teachers in other countries, you know, to fund a classroom, and just this idea that, like, organizations like Help One Now just empower people to whatever it is, you know, and that person threw parties and did all this kind of stuff, just got her friends together and said, hey, can we support this thing? And, like, she didn't have a position at a nonprofit or anything like that. Just the idea of, like, I think people feel like we need some kind of permission to support something sometimes, and it's obviously not true.
Yeah, I talk about it in the book. Like, we, you know, one of the things in the nonprofit cause space is very few people talk about best practices. Like, how do we partner well? You know, like, what does it mean to partner? Like, you know, we sometimes it's so random, or we see an emotional plea or a video and we kind of give or we jump in. But what does it mean to partner? Danielle, who is the teacher here in Austin, she was with us in Haiti, and she's meeting these other teachers. And one of the ways we help is we do is called Help One Classroom. And so it takes about $2,500 US a year to kind of fund classrooms in these other countries, school supplies, curriculum, teacher salaries, you know, like the whole thing. And so Danielle's like, you know, she's a teacher. And she's like, wait, I can raise $2,500. I may not be able to raise $25,000 or $250,000 or but $2,500, like, I can go and get other teachers involved and my friends and my small group. And we'll, you know, so she did like a house show party, and like it may have been like a wine night, you know. And so she got really creative and got her friends involved. And, you know, they funded a classroom for a year. And that creates jobs. That education is vital. And so, like, for Help One Now, like, it's without that happening, we're not around. So Help One Now is not like a group of people in an office. It's a tribe of people around the world saying, here's how I'm going to help. Some folks are like really well-known platforms, and we have Major League Baseball players. We have folks in Hollywood. We have, you know, we have that side. Then we have like this, most of what we do, like everyday normal people who are saying, how do I jump in and make an impact and yet make sure it has wisdom connected to the impact? And I think that's what we're trying to solve.
I wonder if you have advice for people who are, like, getting this message, they want to partner with organizations that exist, and how you evaluate an organization to know if your time, your effort, your money are going to a worthy place. You know, a lot of, you know, it's a big deal. A lot of organizations use up way too much funds for administrative costs. Yeah. A lot of them have good intentions, but are just doing kind of what we talked about earlier. Mm. They're not empowering local people.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, hurting that way. So I'm wondering what you would say to people who just are kind of new to that, yeah, that game, and, you know, how do they evaluate what makes a good organization?
Yeah, it's interesting. So important. And in my year-long research program, when I came back from Zimbabwe, the first time, one of the things I wanted was permission from other orgs doing great work. I didn't want to get in their way. I didn't want to just start a nonprofit because I had an emotional experience. Because oftentimes we start things that actually takes away from the bigger picture.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I had some folks from large, successful organizations say, you should go do that. Like, you're thinking about things that will help all of us. So I think half the battle is nonprofits in general. They're scarcity driven. They can almost be mean. Like, they're so paranoid on raising money. Mm-hmm. You know, so like when I say, man, if you're listening to this and you know, we would love for you to be part of Help One Now. If you jump in with Preemptive Love and help Jeremy, man, we're so happy. Like, there's so many ways to make an impact. So I think the biggest issue is we got to do a little bit of homework. And as we think about doing good, one of the things we don't do well is we don't live an intentional life within that. We're very intentional, like who we marry or, our career path or even what church we go to. But oftentimes we're not very intentional on what it means to give back and do good locally and globally. And so I would encourage people to really think through, do your homework, spend a little time, develop a philosophy that works for you or your family, and then have a clear line of sight. You know, I'm going to start small and I'm going to see what this organization does with this gift. You know, and no org's perfect. And sometimes, you know, people want too much. Like, we give away almost all of our money. You know, it's like, why don't we hear from our kid 10 times a year? Because your kid's 4 hours in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
And, you know, we can't spend all the money on getting there. We want to give the cash to the kid and the community. So, but here's the thing. You got to be able to touch and feel the organization. Are they accessible? Do they communicate well? Are they showing you the impact of the work? But here's what's even more important. Well, they talk about the failures of the work. Because if an org's not failing, they're not innovating. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things we realized real quickly, let's talk about both. And not in a fake, transparent way. Let's be as real as we can. So our tribe will understand everything's not going to work. We're going to have to innovate. And sometimes it may not work. Are you going to be okay with that? And so people stick with us long term because they realize it may not work. But we got to try. So I think communication, transparency, and, you know, are they only communicating to you when they need money? So one of the things we do is we try not to ask for money very much, because if you ask for money all the time, people will begin to ignore you. And so it's really important to be intentional on building the community. So that way they feel like they're involved more than just, I need you to write another check.
Yeah, yeah. So maybe don't adopt the first organization you see a commercial for on TV.
No.
Or maybe no. Any you see a commercial for on
TV. It has red in it. Do not give to that. No, I'm kidding. I mean, so here's what stinks about it. You know, we're literally like in Haiti post-earthquake seeing some of the most tragic. I mean, you're angry how much they had to suffer. And then you're watching massive organizations. Some massive orgs are amazing. I mean, we need the big ones. It's not, we need big orgs. I mean, I love, you know, we need both sides. We need big orgs, small orgs. But there are organizations out there that are, you know, they're literally just wasting money. And it's you know, not like thousands, it's millions and billions. And people are suffering while they waste money. And it's tragic. What that does, though, is for the donor, they lose confidence in all organizations. And so, you know, find the organization that you're confident in, you know they're doing good work, and you can trust them, and then stick with them long term. This is one of the struggles. Don't jump around to too many orgs. Once you kind of find your fight, if you will, stick with that. Because here's what's powerful. When you see the impact of your generosity, my friend Sarah Bessie, she's just such a brilliant writer and blogger, and she helped build a school in Haiti off a trip in 2010, and she came back in 2014, and she saw the school built and the hundreds of kids attending the school and, you know, the impact it was having on the community. And she just, you know, she has tears in her eyes. And what I love about that is, like, for Sarah to come back and see the impact of her generosity is really important. So you want to be able to see the impact of the work because it matters.
Yeah. Well, I think you kind of mentioned this in the beginning, but I think this book is so good for just an on-ramp for some people who, you know, you talked about some of these other books that are so great, but they're also a little complicated, a little involved. And the book is so accessible, I think, for people who are just now getting into this world. I think it's just the perfect on-ramp into it and to help people and educate people. So We'll have links to Help One Now in the show notes and obviously to the book. Yeah. Is there anything else you want to plug before we go? Yeah.
No, you know what? I wrote the book really to do a few things. One, I wanted people to laugh. I wanted people to cry. And I wanted the reader to close the book, maybe take an hour and a half, 2 hours to read it. It's a pretty quick read. And I wanted them to just know that, you know what? They matter and that they can find really powerful ways to make an impact in the world. And so, if we can do that, then we feel like it was worth our time writing the book and helping people here, help people around the world, make the world better. And now more than ever, people need hope. People need to know that. And it's frustrating because all we ever hear about is all the negativity in the world. But there's all this amazing happening all the time. But that's stuff that doesn't get clicks on news channels, and so we don't hear about it. And so surround yourself with people who are bringing hope to the world and who are making the world better, and it will literally improve your personal life.
Mm. Well, Chris, thanks for taking the time, man. It's good to have you.
Oh, so good to be here, Shane. Thanks so much.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Oh, and hey, have you ever thought about starting your very own podcast? I bet you have. And I think you should do it. In fact, I've created a course just for you to teach you everything that I've learned over the last couple of years producing Seminary Dropout. So if you're interested in podcasting and want to learn how, go check out my course. You can go there by typing in podcastingforeveryone.org. And you can get a special discount by typing in the discount code Seminary Dropout, all one word. That'll give you 25% off. So go check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. Okay. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter at Beard on a Bike. That's at Beard on a Bike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press Become a Patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right, thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care. Yeah,